From Florence, Italy, I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Italian citizen, attorney, and guide Katia Giroto joins me again this week to discuss President Obama's trip to Europe and the 70th anniversary of D-Day.
If you talk to the generation of my mom and my dad and my grandparents, then definitely they will have very vivid memories about a war, because a war is not something that you forget.
And later, I'll talk with University of Oklahoma anthropologist Erica Robb Larkins about the thousands of visitors expected in Brazil's poorest neighborhoods during next week's World Cup.
After the Sugarloaf and Cristo, the favela is the third most popular destination in Rio. How does anyone even know what a favela is, right? And so this tells us something interesting about tourism, which is that we don't come to places without ideas about them.
We'll discuss this so-called slum sightseeing after these news headlines. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. I'm here outside of Florence, Italy, with my friend and colleague, Katia Giroto, once again. And we're watching with interest how President Obama is visiting Europe this week, a very quick trip, 4 days, three countries. He's here, Katia, to visit Poland. There he's marking the 25th anniversary of the Solidarity Movement and the country's return to democratic governance. He also met there with the newly elected president of Ukraine and basically reiterated U.S. support for Ukraine and for all former Soviet states and satellites, that they do not need to stand alone in the face of Russian aggression, as promising funding for security forces, defense forces. He then traveled on to Brussels, Belgium, G7 summit, then met with President Hollande in France. And then the big thing culminating in the anniversary, the 70th anniversary of the D-Day invasion of Normandy. And here we are in Italy. Of course, the invasion of France 70 years ago is an important anniversary to commemorate. But it does overshadow in some ways Italy's liberation and Italy's role in the Second World War, especially the suffering that was experienced here from 1943 to 1945. Half a million Italians died during the Second World War. Hundreds of thousands of Allied troops died here. Italians definitely remember this. Everyone was affected. It's left its mark on this country even today.
Yes, Suzette, you're right. Definitely the Second World War is the biggest scar that we have here in Europe. It's something that everybody remember, and it is something that everybody in this old continent need to remember. If we're talking about Italy, definitely is easy to find everywhere, in every city, in every town, something that reminds you about the Second World War. And if you would be able to talk to any Italian family, they will have memories about that. If you talk to the generation of my mom and my dad and my grandparents, then definitely they lived the war, so they will have very vivid memories about a war, because a war is not something that you forget. But I have to say that even the new generation, you see this, they still remember. The war is not just something that we studied at school. It's not just something that we find on our books. It's not just part of our history, but it's part of a daily life, I would say. It's very obvious the impact and the effects that those war had in Italy. And I also would like to say that even if you look at the European Union somehow, you can see this. How? In a way that we always need to remember that if today we do have the European Union and we can have an opinion on the European Union, if we want to be pro-Union, or again, we also have people that are Eurosceptical, well, if we do have this possibility, it's because we had the war, but at the end we did have the liberation. So this is something related, and every time we talk about the European Union, then we need to remind ourselves that European Union was created in order to avoid wars and in order to avoid things like what happened, or the things that happened during the Second World War.
Well, you mentioned how Italians, even today, young people alike, remember. I mean, there are physical remembrances throughout this country, throughout Europe. I mean, obviously, President Obama and others who are visiting Normandy visit the American cemetery. They visited the cemeteries where Allied troops died in, you know, large, large numbers. But we even visited today an American cemetery here out just outside of Florence with the OU alumni group. And you explained to us how Italian citizens today are so appreciative of what American soldiers did in this country 70 years ago.
definitely. During the Second World War, of course, we had a lot of Italians that died during the war and a lot of Europeans, but we also had to remember that a lot of American soldiers died for the freedom of this country. So this was definitely a very high price that not only Italy, not only Europe, but also United States of America had to pay in order to give our land back to us.
Well, Katya, thank you so much. And thank you for being a part of our alumni group this week as we're finishing our mini city tour of Italy. It's been a tremendous experience for all of us. And it's been great to get to know this country so much better from every angle. You've really taught us a lot. And thank you for joining us on Worldviews.
Thank you very much. It was a very big pleasure to have you here.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you may have. Leave a comment by visiting the Worldviews program page of our website, kgou.org. You can also get in touch with us via Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU, or at Suzette Gralat. Next, University of Oklahoma anthropologist Erica Robb Larkins. She last appeared on this program in February to talk about inequality in Brazil ahead of the World Cup and 2016 Olympics. We'll have a longer discussion today about the history and pacification of Rio de Janeiro's favela neighborhoods. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. The 2014 World Cup begins Thursday. But earlier this week, soccer's international governing body expressed concern that many stadium sites won't be ready. And legendary Brazilian striker Ronaldo said he was appalled by his country's preparations for the sport's biggest event. The tournament, and the Summer Olympics 2 years from now, has also turned the world's attention to Rio de Janeiro's poorest neighborhoods. My guest, Erica Robb Larkins, lived in one of these favelas while working on a project about policing in the slums ahead of these two sporting events. Erica Robb Larkins, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
So, Erica, you have a very interesting book that you're about to publish. You've spent a lot of time working and living in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And so you've written a book about this experience, a very interesting experience that you've had living in a favela in Rio. So let's just start there. What are these favelas? We hear about them. We've heard you before in previous shows talk about them. You know, what are these things? What are their history? Where do they come from?
We have to go way back. So the favela is basically a product of Brazilian colonial history. It's rooted in racial inequality. It's rooted in sort of unequal access to land. So what happened was, you know, Brazil received the most slaves of any country in the New World. And when they abolished slavery, they were also had the distinction of being the last country in the world to abolish slavery. They had a huge African descended population. And they didn't have land or really anywhere. So what you find was people that were moving off of plantations into big cities, and there was nothing in place sort of to welcome these, for these people to settle. So they took the parts of the city, they moved into the parts of the city that nobody wanted, which at the time in Rio was the places on the hillside. This is really different than in other places where the hillside with the beautiful view tends to be the place of the wealthy. In Rio, it was the opposite. Those were the precarious places with landslides and mudslides and rain, and the lower places closer to the ocean were more desirable. So you have lots and lots of people that come and start to build their own houses in these areas. And not only are they building their own houses, but at the same time, they're building the city itself. This is the labor that built Rio and built every major Brazilian city. And these people would trade, they would work for their boss in the city, and he would maybe give them some, you know, extra materials that they would use to go home and add an extra room on their house and et cetera, et cetera. Now, this land, here this goes to the other issue, this other colonial legacy, which is that much of this land was owned by large landholders who were not present. And there wasn't really anyone to police the development of these communities. Every so often, somebody would come in and maybe tear them down, but people would put them right back up again. So over time, you have really small favelas that grew into these large cities almost and became increasingly more difficult to remove. And over time, people fought for and gained right to their land and were able to stay there.
Well, these communities are clearly something that are just incredible to see. And there are over 1,000 of them. I mean, 1,000 of these hillsides, I guess, where communities have been built.
So actually, most of them are not on the hillsides. Most of them are located on level land. But the ones that have tended to always sort of be the iconic favelas, the ones that you see in pictures and in movies, are the ones that are next to the wealthy neighborhoods overlooking the beautiful beach. Most of them have not nearly such a privileged view. But these favelas in particular have become iconic of Rio and iconic of what a favela is. But it's important, I think, as you mentioned, to realize that there are lots of them and they're incredibly diverse. You have favelas that are very small, a couple hundred people. You have favelas. The largest favela in Latin America is in Rio. The government says it has 70,000 people, but the community itself says it has 300,000 people. And not only do you have differences between favelas, inside of every favela you have an internal diversity that's often overlooked sort of from the outside. You have an internal class structure. You have property values that are different. And all of it depends sort of on your access to the, you know, so-called formal city. So if you live near the road, for example, your house is worth more money because you can get on a bus, you can go to the city. It takes less effort for you to get to your job. If you live in an interior part in the favela that doesn't have roads, that only has alleyways, you have to walk for 15, 20 minutes maybe to get your bus. So those properties would be devalued and those people would be seen as sort of more lower class favela residents. And you'd think that maybe these things wouldn't matter inside of a poor community, but they really do.
Well, that is what's so striking when you see them is that, I mean, these are really, in some of them anyway, are kind of these cities within the city of Rio, and the buses are going through them, and you've got businesses lining them. I mean, McDonald's is there, banks are there. It's not like, these images one might have in their mind of these shanty towns with, kind of buildings built upon buildings, houses built upon houses, but they're actual cities within cities, or at least some of the bigger ones are. I mean, I think that's what's really striking. And so that's where the workers live. And that's where, people that are working in the main city of Rio, I guess. But they're not all the same, I guess, is what I'm kind of hearing you say. You can't necessarily see one favela and say you've seen all favelas. I mean, they're very diverse and very different. And even within them, they're diverse and different.
Right, absolutely. And the idea of the city within the city is really wonderful. When I was doing my long-term research here, I lived in a favela, one of the biggest ones, and I could get pizza delivered to my house. I could get sushi delivered to my house. I could buy almost anything that I needed inside of the favela. If I didn't want to leave, I didn't have to. I could get groceries. I could get, DVDs. You could get everything, absolutely everything. So there is a way in which they're a city within the city. And yet, for most of the people that live there, they do work outside. So there's like this, they call it sometimes a pendulum city, right, where in the morning, everybody goes out to go to work in the city. And in the evening, everybody comes back. And so there is that movement and that connection between the favela and the city that is absolutely essential to understanding both sides. If you didn't have the favela, the city wouldn't function. Who would drive the buses? Who would clean the houses? There would be no one. And so this idea, I think one of the big things that has existed for a long time is the idea that favelas are very marginal. So they are. People are socially marginalized. They're politically marginalized because they're poor. But in terms of thinking of their role in the city, they're absolutely central. They're not at the margins. They're in the middle of everything, making everything else in the city possible.
My guest is University of Oklahoma anthropologist Erica Robb Larkins. We'll discuss the government response to these favela neighborhoods right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm speaking with OU anthropologist and international studies professor Erica Robb Larkins about the favela neighborhoods in Brazil. When we left off, she said even though the residents are socially and politically marginalized, the city of Rio de Janeiro couldn't function without them. Well, let's talk for a minute about the government response to these communities, because, I mean, obviously their history comes from the fact that these were ex-slaves, did not have land. They settled in this land that was basically public land that nobody owned, nobody was watching, nobody was managing. And so over the many, many years, and particularly in recent years, there have been these attempts to make formal many of these pieces of property, provide ownership to these pieces of property. I mean, there are schools, there are low-income housing areas that are actually look different from the kind of historic, you know, favela homes. So the government seems to be responding to a lot of this. They're giving them official house numbers and all of that sort of thing, right? And they're also sending in the police, and they're trying to clean up some of the organized crime that has grown up in these previously ungoverned areas, right? So tell us a little bit about that.
So I think the government has always been present in some form or another in favelas, whether or not it's through their absence as a form of presence, strange as that sounds, through neglect, through not providing essential services like water or electricity. But the government has also been very present in terms of its policing. And now this is going to vary. If you're in a favela that's in a wealthy neighborhood, for example, you're much more likely that favela will probably be much more heavily policed. Favelas that are located on the margins of the city might not get as much police attention. And police attention in the favela has not ever been a positive thing for residents. You know, just like all this idea that all favelas are the same, which is sort of a dominant theme in thinking about them, the police and other government officials have tended to think of all favela residents as the same and have reduced all favela residents to a category of criminal because there's a very small percentage of the population that is involved in organized crime. It's really hard to get accurate estimates for this kinds of thing, but residents will say something like, you know, 1% to 3% of the population. But in the eyes, especially of police, it becomes everyone. And so the favela has always had a very violent, repressive policing that has always been the style. And so residents are very skeptical of police. They don't trust police. They've been persecuted by police. So in the recent, and especially since there's always been some sort of movements to reform this with sort of stops and starts and it's been mostly unsuccessful. But with the World Cup and the Olympics coming, there has been much more pressure on the city to be rethinking how favelas are policed and how sort of the favela needs to be. It's not just about how they're policed. It's also about how space is managed in the favela, who controls the space. Things like providing house numbers and things like that are also about exerting government control. It's about encouraging people to think about mapping their space in different ways according to state models, with roads and maps. And up until recently, there's been no maps of a favela. You couldn't get a map of a favela. So it's mapping it in terms of police. It's mapping it, it's policing it, and it's also formalizing the economy in certain ways. And unfortunately, much of this has not benefited favela residents. And it's still been rife with a lot of problems. Even if perhaps it's well-intentioned, it hasn't really worked out.
Well, one of the things that is particularly interesting is the kind of tourism that has emerged around these communities. Now, your book deals with this at length, and you've lived there yourself. You've watched it. You've seen it happen. I've, you know, partaken of this, you know, slum tourism, I guess, if you want to call it that. Many people do. But the fact that people, outsiders, come in to kind of peer into this life and see what it's like, which on the one hand, it seems kind of weird, you know, that you're, you know, kind of looking at this community as if you're, you know, like going to the zoo or something. But on the other hand, it's incredibly educational. It's incredibly important to see it for yourself. Because there's so much misconception about what these communities are all about. And so being there and actually physically seeing it, it really changes the way in which you perceive it. So it's the good and the bad, I guess, with this kind of tourism. What do you think?
Well, and I think you've exactly hit upon the tension there. And that's exactly sort of how residents and tour operators and everyone that's involved in the favela tourism industry just talks about it, is sort of about from these two sides. You know, the biggest favela in Rio, Jocinha, has had a pretty booming tourism industry since the early 90s. And they say that after the Sugarloaf and Cristo, that the favela is the third most popular destination in Rio, which would mean, you know, thousands of tourists a month. So we have to ask, why are people going? And I think that, you know, how do they even know about it? How does anyone even know what a favela is, right? And so this tells us something interesting about tourism, which is that we don't come to places without ideas about them. And the favela has been featured really centrally in a lot of the Brazilian media exports that we see. It's in all the guidebooks. It's in all the films. I mean, most of the big films, City of God was a huge, it's probably the most well-known Brazilian film and you know ever, which is all about a favela. So people come because they have these ideas. Now, when they get there, they might see something very different, but it's oftentimes those preconceived notions that people bring with them to the tours. And that influences what they see, it influences what tour guides say, and how residents act, because residents also know they have preconceived ideas about tourists. They know, they think, oh, tourists want to see this or they want to see that. So it's not just in the moment of the actual tour. There's all these things that are happening before the tour too. And the industry itself, I mean, it's a number of big companies that operate. They have varying degrees of involvement with the community that they work in. There are some resident-run tours, but they're very small still, and most of them are run by people that don't live in the favela, so there's already kind of a power dynamic there. But beyond that, we have to ask about the tourists themselves. This is what people are usually very interested in, right, is why do people go? Why do people want to go? And I think you're right that on the one hand, you want to go and see the real Rio. This is how people really live. And it is an important corrective to the beach and, you know, the luxury areas where most tourist hotels are. So it's important. But then at the same time, you have to ask, you know, it's still about the tourist's education and the tourist's awareness. That's the focus. It's not on the community. The community is a tool for the tourist to learn something. So we have to ask a little bit about that power dynamic and what that means.
Well, that's an excellent point, and how that tourist industry really comes around to benefit the community. I mean, on the one hand, the change in perception, I think, at least in somewhat kind of intangibly benefits the community, right? But how does it really come back around? So choosing your company wisely and making sure that it does contribute back to that community is really important.
And I think the other thing that I have come to believe about it is that it's not, you can, as long as you go and you have your awareness raised, that's one thing, but that's not enough. It's not just about having your awareness raised or you being more educated as a tourist. You have to also choose to do something with that knowledge. And so I think if we think about it in that way, if people choose to do something with what they learned, then it becomes perhaps a more real form of social awareness.
Absolutely. Knowledge is never enough. It's just the start. Well, thank you so much, Erica, for being with us on Worldviews to share this very interesting information about an interesting, fascinating part of the world.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with University of Oklahoma anthropologist and Brazil scholar Erica Robb Larkins. You can find photos from my February trip to Brazil and a few of Rio's favela neighborhoods on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with OU's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show. For Katya Giroto, I'm Suzette Gralat.